Welcome to this EG session on the London offices market, and we're going to be talking about how landlords should respond to the shifting market. I'm Damien Wild and I'm editor of EG. I recognise some of your faces from the Blue Room earlier, which I'm pleased to see, and there we talked about the market, the current market, from an investment point of view. So it's a neat bookending, this session. It's almost as if we planned it, isn't it, to take that conversation forward from a leasing point of view. And I certainly, with that debate earlier, certainly felt comforted by the tone of that debate, and I'm sure this afternoon's panellists will take us to a similarly happy place. But I shouldn't prejudge what they're going to say, so we will find out. So to our panel, on my far right is Jonathan Evans, Office Leasing Director, Alma Kantar. Next to him is Ross Blair, Senior Managing Director and Head of Hines UK. Mike Wiseman is Head of Office Leasing at British Land. Stephanie McMahon is from BNP Paribas Real Estate's research team, and James Locke is Managing Director of Blackstone. But first, to set the scene, we have a brief presentation from a colleague of mine from EG's analytics team, Graham Sean. Graham.
Thank you, Damien. Good afternoon, everyone. My role really is to, as Damien said, set the scene on how London office landlords should respond, just by looking statistically at what it is actually that they're responding to. First of all, to look at rolling 12-month take-up from the kind of start of 2008 through to the midpoint of this year. And if we look at the chart, we can see the kind of peaks and troughs that we've seen over the past 10 years, with a little bit of a pickup towards the midpoint of this year, as we can see. From the kind of mid to end of the GFC period up to 2013, average 12-month take-up at 10.5 million square feet. And then we had the boom time, really, in London offices, 14 million square feet on average from 2013 to the start of 2016. And a little bit of a sort of kind of series of quieter quarters from the midpoint of 2016 have meant that a little bit of a dip has happened since that time, 11.2 million square feet rolling take-up on average. And the impactful thing really for landlords in that regard is that it's impacted the supply rate, which is now charted on the right-hand axis. We can see a few kind of flashpoints, the peaks and troughs of London supply rate. So Q4 2015, 4.3% of the overall stock was being actively marketed, and that's just eased gradually over the last few quarters to where it is now at 7.2%. Dual effect, really, a little bit more choice for occupiers, not necessarily a bad thing, but also potentially having a decelerative effect on rental growth, which we've seen in that 2013 to 2016 period especially. Second thing to look at is average lease lengths on newly signed deals over the last 10 years or so. It's bobbed up a little bit this year to 6.7 years on average. This is across London offices, so including secondhand and new build within the statistics, but down from 9 years on average back in 2007. But the really interesting thing is the time to first break, which is now charted slightly lighter blue there, 3.1 years. So again, it has that effect of kind of increased flexibility across central London for occupiers, but also means that a lot more activity is required, or proactivity is perhaps required, from landlords moving forward. And that's reflected when we look at the amount of space that's kind of up for expiry or break between 2018 and 2023, which I think, yeah, you can see on that, it's cut off on mine. It's gone a little bit psychedelic, that map, so apologies for that. But it's around 42.5 million square feet of London office space across over 2,000 buildings up for expiry or break before 2024, with a great deal of those, around 430 buildings, which are at risk of entire vacation purely from lease events in the next 5 years or so. So obviously those lease breaks and those shorter leases potentially meaning a little bit more proactivity on the landlord side. So that's a little bit of a quick tour of statistically what's going on with London offices at the moment. There's certainly some encouraging statistics in Q3 from a preliminary point of view at the moment. We're reporting on those in a couple of weeks. But for now, I'll hand back to Damien and the panel for their insights. Thank you.
Thank you, Graham. Now I'm going to test whether our panel have eyes in the back of their head. So don't worry, I'm not. So in our investment presentation this morning, it was a reasonably rosy picture presented around opportunities nationally. That was a national session rather than just a London session. Here it's not looking too bad either. Jonathan, are you surprised by London's resilience?
Is this on? Yes, you hear it. I love the analogy that basically London is basically the US just crammed into one city. And the reason I like that, because if you look at the different sectors across London, whether it's the pharmaceuticals, financial services, fintech, government, you know, if you put that across, it isn't reliant on a single occupier sector in terms of how it's performing. And that is an underlying performance. So I'm actually optimistic that London remains a place where people want to be, and that tends to, and that's also changed, because 25 years ago you had the city, which was based on financial services and banking, and that underwrote that, and the West End was very different, and there was a place called Midtown in the middle. And basically London has homogenised, so in the way that a lot of occupiers are much more footloose and spread across central London. So the geography has grown, the occupiers are more footloose, and we do have these, the villages of London now are really focused around the sectors. And so my first point is that you've got an underlying strength of lots of different sectors that want to be in London for various reasons. So I am optimistic about it from that point of view. I've got other points I like to make, but I'll move on to someone else to add to that.
We'll come back to those points, good or bad. Ross, that point about London's resilience, does it surprise you, or are we ignoring some underlying problems?
No, I mean, clearly we have challenges to get through, and occupiers are hesitating, making certain long-term commitments for obvious reasons. But I think everything Jonathan said, we completely buy into. My responsibility is the UK business, but I interact with my European colleagues a lot, and they often smirk when they see me and expect that they're going to be stealing all of the tenants out of London into German cities or Paris or wherever. But despite the headlines that continue to come through on that, there's just very little evidence of it actually happening, and we don't believe that it will happen. So no, we remain very positive. We remain a business that wants to carry on investing in the UK and specifically London, and would very much like to be developing more space and bringing it through to the market. So that in itself is a sign of confidence that there's life left in the city.
And are they still smirking as much, your French, German?
I think they'll carry
Irish
on smirking for a bit longer, but hopefully once we get beyond spring 19, they'll stop.
Okay. Mike, the resilience point. You know, does London feel as resilient as it did 12 months ago? Is our resilience holding up?
Well, I think I'd echo what these guys have said. If you went back 12 months, we're all aware sort of the events, the big political events hanging over us. So there is an element of uncertainty. I think I feel quite lucky in the job that I do. I'm talking to a lot of decision makers in large businesses from overseas, and you know, they still see that London is a place they want to do business. And I think that gives us quite a lot of confidence. You only have to see some of the big deals that have happened in the last 12 months, Apple and Google, Wells Fargo, Deutsche Bank. You know, these are all big overseas businesses committing to London, demonstrating their commitment to this city.
And what impact do those headline-grabbing commitments have? Does it cause, is there a direct correlation with others deciding to sign? Well, if Apple is committed to London, I'll commit to London.
Well, I think it's interesting. This is something I talk to a lot about with our comms guy and our PR guys. You look at the Deutsche Bank deal, which is a phenomenal deal for London. You know, big German bank committing after many years. And I don't necessarily like to give credit to our major competitor, but it's a fantastic deal. Yet the majority of the mainstream press reported it in a negative way. They talked about the job losses that were coming. They talked about a reduction in size, transfer of balance sheet to Germany. And you know, I think that's a bit disappointing. But I think when you get past the headlines and you talk to the occupiers, as we're talking to, the message is that they recognise that, you know, space is getting eaten up, other businesses are committing, and that's giving them the confidence to do so.
Okay, thank you. And Stephanie, do you have smirking colleagues as well?
Smirking. I'm pretty surprised by the figures that we're still seeing in London, if I'm honest. A year ago, I was kind of like, okay, I think we're at the top of the market anyway, and I think the market is going to slow. And I can't disagree with the data. There have been some very big deals, without a doubt. But I do think that London, similar to other major cities around the world, is seeing a kind of shrinking of that office space over time. So each of those big deals, and I can't confirm this, but more than likely, those occupiers are taking slightly less space than they were originally. So I do think it's kind of masking actually an evolution that's seeing in the London office market.
Okay, so are you looking at forecasts for 12 months out now? What do they look like?
We look at rental forecasts, but not stock absorption or anything. But our rental forecasts are flat at best, yeah.
And your hunch would be on stock absorption?
That it's declining.
Yeah, I mean, I've got some Just in relation to that question, I think we've seen now 6 months of negative net absorption, which is always a good precursor to maybe how the market could respond in this situation. And one slide that Graham put up was around take-up, which, you know, I'm sort of a bit more cynical about, to be honest, because if you look at the availability, if you look at the availability forecast, I think it was 14 million square feet of available space with a availability rate about 7.2%. If you actually dig underneath that, about 67% of that available space is second-hand space. Now, that in itself is basically, from my perspective, probably one of the biggest handbrakes to this sort of optimistic outlook. Because when you look at the space that these guys have all successfully leased in the last 12 months, it's basically grade A space. It's basically today 2 million square foot only of available space in central London, which is a staggering achievement in light of some of the macroeconomic challenges we face. But when you take 9.5 million square feet of potentially obsolete space, the question which I think we all need to ask ourselves as landlords, to answer your original question, is, you know, at what price do we basically pass on the liability to someone else? Because rates are expensive to hold product. Obviously, you've got vacancy costs in terms of your own financing. And when you look at the forecast for rental growth, I think people are yet to sort of absorb what the impact of that grey space, secondhand space could be on the market going forward. So, you know, I think it looks a manageable situation with regards to the occupier outlook. But I think from a landlord's perspective, that secondhand space is something we'll need to very closely monitor.
Okay, and when you say closely monitor, what do you mean?
Well, what are the options? You either basically have to invest a lot of capital into that space, which is capital intensive in an environment where you may not feel comfortable about investing. You can pass the liability onto a third party in the form of a sale of that space. What we're seeing even currently is there's a slight bifurcation appearing in the capital markets. We may have spoken about this earlier on your discussion, but from a London context, over the last 6 to 8 weeks, you've seen examples of where list price for to be vacant or vacant space is being definitely considered in a different way from an investor perspective. People's assumptions are being changed, we believe. Some of the growth forecasts are definitely being tuned down. Cost inflation is a key concern. So I can't see that market where there is short-term void and or pending vacancy responding in the way it has done for the last 12 months. For sure, the stable trophy stuff that the likes of British Land, Amacanta, ourselves have built, there's fantastic demand. Arguably demand and yields that we didn't expect to see. But how do you basically digest vacancy over the next 12 to 24 months with some of the comments already heard from the panel? I think it's a far more complicated outlook than probably people are giving it credit for today.
Okay, I think the panel seems to be splitting around me with me sat in the middle. That wasn't intentional. But Mike, to James's point there, what's going to happen with non-prime stock?
Look, I think that's very much in line with what we see. I talk from our experience of, you know, having high quality office space in fantastic locations around campuses right the way across London, and we're seeing tremendous demand for that. You know, our success at Paddington Central at Clarges was a result of having great product. I know that's not the case across the market, and that's certainly something we need to keep an eye on. But, you know, from our business perspective, that's why we are focusing on the best quality product in the best location, because we think demand remains strong for that.
Okay, so you're more interested in developing new excellent stock for those big global occupiers than perhaps investing capital in refurbishment?
I don't think it necessarily needs to be big, shiny new offices like we're delivering at 100 Liverpool Street. I think it needs to be whatever sector it's in or whatever location it's in, whatever market it's in, it needs to be best in class. It needs to be interesting. So it's whatever product you're delivering. And, you know, we're delivering refurbished space at Blossom Street. We know there's a lot of small floor plates coming through in the northern city fringe. Ours is going to have to be better quality, well thought through, and better delivered than anybody else. And that's how we're focusing wherever we're doing business. You know, we've got Canada Water, where we're going to deliver 1 million-plus square foot of offices over the next few years. We think there's a market for that. It's delivering a different product than you would see in the city core. But it's something that works for that market. It'll be best in class at that price point.
Okay, thank you. And Ross, you seem to be saying the same thing earlier, that development is what interests you.
Yeah, and I also think that the lines between prime and non-prime, in terms of the specifics at the asset level, are changing. So 5 or 10 years ago, whenever we were delivering new space, be that new build or newly refurbished, there was a basic set of criteria we always achieved, or we always sought to achieve, otherwise we were very worried that it was unlettable. I think as the occupier type in London has changed so dramatically and tenants have become so fleet of foot, with tech and media firms paying big rents, I think buildings that we would not have considered refurbishable, if that's a word, previously, now very much are refurbishable, because if you can create a certain character within that space, it might not be so critical that you have the suspended ceiling or the clear floor to ceiling height or the floor void, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that that line between prime and non-prime is being blurred, and that's being evidenced in the rents being achieved on some buildings which certainly would not have been considered prime, achieving rents higher than prime in some submarkets. So that's the type of product we're specifically looking for right now, trying to look for those buildings that you can make feel very special, but where you don't necessarily need to provide all the bells and whistles that you would have sought to do 10 years ago at great expense.
Okay, thank you. Jonathan, Ross there talking about how barriers between, distinctions between prime and secondary are changing. You talked about how London's changing and markets, submarkets are changing. Do we need to rethink our language?
Can I just answer Stephanie's point? Because I think it was interesting. Let's look back a little bit where we've come from, particularly around the various uses in central London. So a lot of the office stock that we've seen in parts of core parts of the West End and on the fringes of the city have gone to residential. We've had the introduction of student housing. There's the hotel market has changed dramatically over the last 20 years. So that was was cannibalising a little bit of office space that wasn't maybe suit for office space. So I think that was a dynamic that has changed. It's created life and vibrancy to a lot of these sectors or the geographical areas around London. And secondly, on James's point, I think that if you look historically at central London, then basically 5% of the office stock disappears out for obsolescence, mainly along the development lines that we all try and do. So, you know, building up sites and that sort of deals with some of that secondhand space. And then you get the other element, which is that large landlords are one thing, but then again, London is owned and run by lots and lots of different landlords who have small units, and they are imaginative about how they use them. So I actually think that a lot of areas, for instance, Soho would be a classic example about that. It's got multi-ownerships, lots of different uses in the same building that someone like Shaftesbury invented with retail and workshops and offices and residential and so on. So that you'll find then increasingly that'll deal with the secondhand stock. I now can't remember what your question was, Damien, having gone through that.
I like the acknowledgement that you weren't answering it, though. Does our language need to change in terms of how we describe different parts of London, how we describe London, and how we describe prime versus secondary?
What I'm seeing is the talk. If you discuss it with the occupier and the potential sort of customer, if you like, for a lot of them, is that a lot of us, then they're describing what they want. And so the language is, it used to be very geographical, as I said earlier, you know, banking in the city and media in the West End. We're finding that there is a supply pull effect by good stock across central London for larger occupiers. So the language is changing. If you build the environment, which has got regeneration in it with retail, offices, residential, public realm, etc., you will attract a variety of occupiers to that space. So the language has changed from that point of view, in my view, in that places and destinations like King's Cross, which look back 20 years, what was it like? So that has changed. And then I think the other element has changed is the trying to get the flexibility around the occupancy for the occupier in terms of what they occupy their space, how their staff occupy, how they get there and so on is really important. And I think the developers and those who provide space are really listening to those occupiers. And a lot of it is collaboration and the feedback is really useful.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
I think just to pick up on that question about location and how we as an industry perhaps look at locations and our legacy around locations. So we have areas where historically, to your point, we've clustered and we go, well, those are the most expensive areas in central London for offices for those reasons where that clustering took place. But if you look at accessibility today, which is the highest motivator of employees, it's their ability to get to work in a commutable distance, it's actually around location, and they don't always fit. Those geographies don't necessarily fit. I mean, I work in Hill Street, just off Berkeley Square, which has the unfortunate aspect of being probably one of the worst located places in central London, that you can't get to a tube station within about a 10-minute walk, depending on how fast you walk. So, you know, this is standard Mayfair, seen as one of the best places in London to occupy, and it actually going down to London Bridge or King's Cross or somewhere like that, or Oxford Circus is far, far better for employees.
Okay, and also if geography is changing and how we value geography, how about that distinction between prime and secondary? Are we having to reevaluate things around the city fringe, for instance, where some of the most coveted buildings aren't the shiny boxes of old?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the rental differential between some of those locations is huge. And I think we've seen that at King's Cross, where you've seen that very dramatic rental uplift over just 3 or 4 years, really reflecting that accessibility.
Okay, James?
I mean, to answer the question around should we redefine the historical geographical boundaries, the simple answer from my perspective is yes. I mean, it's irrelevant. I mean, whether you're a city occupier from a historical context, makes no difference to the CFO, who is now an integral part of this discussion process, around where his staff are going to relocate to. We've done 1.1 million square feet of lease up, all on refurbished space, in central London over the last 14 months. And we look at the breakdown of occupiers, it's very clear. It's 46% are in the tech and digital media business, 21% actually are from financials, asset management primarily, and then the balance is a mix between professional services and other industries. Not one of those tenants, without exception, on 43 transactions, had a specific location criteria. I need to be in this location within 1 square mile of basically X, Y, and Z. So for sure, we need to basically change, and we need to basically get away from this idea of, you know, rent freeze in West End versus rent freeze in City. Well, as far as I'm concerned, they're almost comparable. And Stephanie's point about the rent differential between north of Shoreditch and City Core, well, believe it or not, it's probably £20 a square foot more now in north of Shoreditch for the right building versus the historical City Core. And that goes to the other question around how we respond to occupiers. I mean, I think there are three things. First is this point about efficiency, which I think was picked up by Ross about building more efficient product. Completely agree. I mean, efficiency is the primary objective of any occupier who comes around one of our buildings. And the reason for that is very straightforward. You know, the efficiency is calculated not on per square foot basis, but on a per head basis. So when you bake that into discussion on affordability, it goes straight to the CFO again. So you've got efficiency, you've got affordability per head, and then you've got the modern working environment, which is a must-have, because, you know, these buildings are becoming extensions of the company's core values, brands. I mean, it sounds a bit, I'm definitely not a marketeer, as you can probably tell, but I mean, having a building which represents what the building stands for is an integral part of the decision-making process. It goes to talent retention, it goes to a feeling of ownership, it goes to collaborative workspace. I'm sure we'll come on to it. So answer the question, geographical boundaries are relevant, key considerations, efficiency, affordability, and modern working
and
space.
Connectivity as well, that was definitely...
For sure, I mean, I'm quite a bullish person on London, having sort of travelled a bit around the world. I think, you know, we've got our issues, but personally, I've got to jump on the underground or get a cab, and it is well connected. I mean, I have the fortunate position of working in Berkeley Square, so I'm not as negative as Stephanie, but connectivity is key, obviously, and Crossrail will be a major part of improving that over the next 3 or 4 years.
Okay, thank you. And Mike, I'm going to stick with this branding point for just a little bit longer and then move on. But prime and secondary, and in retail, I've noticed, no one likes to say they have a secondary shopping centre anymore. The new distinctions are being created all the time there. Do you think the same needs to be true of offices if we are going to deal with stock that risks becoming redundant otherwise?
Well, in terms of this difference between prime and secondary, I think, look, it all comes down at the moment to sort of location, quality of product within any given market. And, you know, there's some great quality product which has been delivered in strange locations that, you know, we historically wouldn't have looked at. I think it's looking across London, looking at different types of product, all the sorts of things we've just been talking about in terms of the things that support businesses, support what they're trying to achieve.
Okay, thank you. And Jonathan, is there an ideal tenant mix here? James talked about how Blackstone's recent transactions broke down. Given that financial services is looking uncertain, given that professional services firms may be looking to utilise their space differently and tech firms are growing very quickly, do you have an ideal tenant mix in mind?
Yeah, I think you really want to look at the sectors that exist and those emerging around central London, and you'd like them represented all in your portfolio, because you wouldn't want to be exposed to one particular sector.
So what are they, and what's your ideal balance?
Well, I think that if you typically look at the central London occupational financial services sector would like, you'd like to have sort of, you know, 30% of your portfolio exposed to that. The media and associated industries would be 30%. It used to be you'd have government, but now you probably, you can't find them here anyway, so it would be difficult. And then the business service sector is, you know, another sort of 25%. So that's the sort of mixture you'd expect, with other being the remainder. And I think the interesting thing is, if you look at the sort of pie charts of 20 years ago of the city versus the West End, and you compare it now, then it does break up, and Stephanie's sort of charts of who's acquiring what would be broken up into six or six, seven different sectors for most markets. And that is, that's actually going back to the point I made at the very beginning, that's the strength for London, is that we are not exposed to any of those single occupational markets. And now that's across the market because of the footloose nature of the occupiers. So the geography of London has grown, but the connectivity has shrunk.
Okay, thank you. Is anyone's ideal tenant mix very different to that, or is that very typical, that split?
Not being contrarian, go on after you, Ross.
No, I was going to say, we don't have a set tenant mix, but pretty much everything we do in the office space, we do with a view to exiting in the short to medium term. So it's less about wanting X percent in this sector and Y percent in the other sector, but it's all about making sure that the buyer of that building will get comfortable with the credit of the tenant. And I think it's fair to say that right across the board, if you look at all the assets that have traded in the past 12, 24 months in London, none of them stand out as being a type of tenant that an investor does or doesn't want. They seem to be
pretty, not defined by sector.
It doesn't seem to be. I mean, it's more to do with the quality of building, the rental level, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't seem so sector specific in terms of what the buyers want.
Okay. Just to give you a perfect segue, Damien, into your next question. But I mean, one sector which probably is underweight but fast growing is obviously that of flexible office space. So if you look at just the take-up stats alone, I think this year we're looking at annualized, this is 18% of space being taken up by the flexible workspace sector. That was 8% only last year. So an incredible growth. And when you look at the portfolios of ours, Almacantar's, British Lands, Hines going forward, I think there will be a high proportion of flexible office providers within those buildings.
Higher than 18? You know, I'm going to push you for a number.
I wouldn't know. Across our sector, we have 12%, and we have the benefit of obviously making an investment in a recent provider, the Office Group, but also WeWork, Mindspace. And I'm sure that there'll be hundreds of other names fastly appearing on the occupier landscape who believe they can offer the perfect flexible office solution to their customers.
You're growing your own, Mike, aren't you?
Yes, we are. So I think in terms of our portfolio at the moment, we've got a couple of occupiers providing their own flexible workspace. We think this is an incredibly important part of the market. We spent a little while looking at what the other offers were. And then launched Story earlier this year, and we see that being a increasingly important part of our portfolio at all of our campuses, all of our locations. And that's, you know, from our point of view, that's in direct response to listening to our customers. You know, it's for two reasons. We historically didn't really be able to deal with small occupiers looking for flexibility. You know, if you got below 10,000 square foot, you couldn't really have a conversation with British Land. And the other part is more and more of our existing occupiers were putting project space into other locations. So, you know, the first deal we did in this space was for Kingfisher Digital, who are one of our biggest occupiers on both the retail and office side of our portfolios. And we were able to help them grow by offering something different. So, you know, without question, I agree that this is the one area of our portfolio that we'll see growing significantly over the next few years.
What do you think it might grow to? A quarter? A third?
I think that's hard to say at this point, but we'll wait and see.
Okay, but you will, as well as offering your own, you will continue to offer space to other providers as well?
At the moment, we're very much focused on delivering our own. We think we've got a differentiated proposition to that of our competitors, so we're not focusing on the very smallest end of the market. We start at about 20 desks, 20 to 70 desks is our sort of sweet spot. So at the moment, focused on our own, and we'll see how that goes. It's only a few months in, we've only got about 80,000 square foot up and running, another 50,000 square foot coming in the next few months, potentially another 100 or so behind that. But let's ask that question in a year.
Okay, thank you. And Stephanie, where do you think flexible workspace providers might get to in terms of the proportion of space they account for?
I mean, I think that's a very difficult question to answer.
I'm getting that
sense. I know. So I'm also probably going to slightly circumvent it. I think, you know, the time is right now that we are able to offer occupiers more flexibility than ever before. I mean, we've done some recent analysis that shows that, you know, landlords' approach to long leasing is without a doubt the best approach. That's where you get the best returns, and that's where you see the best capital growth. But the fact is, that's not what the customer wants anymore. And perhaps now we have the technology that will allow that we haven't had previously. We can take some of the friction and the cost out of the market with plug and play opportunities and the like. Things like blockchain, you know, which will make it faster to be able to lease space and more seamless, perhaps at the risk or the detriment of companies like mine who are currently doing that on behalf of others. So this evolution of technology will without a doubt assist. And so I can't give you a number, I'm afraid. I could make one up, but it probably wouldn't be very helpful. But without a doubt, we're going only in one direction.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to give up on the number. But Jonathan, still on flexible workspace providers, it's a sector in its infancy, and sectors, as they evolve, they mature and they change. Do you see changes coming through already?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was saying earlier, I think someone mentioned to me that the New York market, where the flexible space offered about 10% of the total stock. And I think that's interesting. If you've got a 240 million square foot market in central London, then you've got 24 million square feet of potential flexible space in London, and that might be an interesting way to start as to where it actually affects the market. I think that there has been a structural shift in the way people occupy space. I think there are financial reasons and lifestyle and working lifestyle reasons why there are providers that need to provide the flexibility. So landlords are being forced to offer it. The funny enough, the deal that we did on South Bank Place emerged as talking to WeWork for two or three floors to start with, because all the other occupiers we were talking to in the space felt that was an incredible advantage to have that in the building. And it emerged that they then took the whole building. But I think that the occupier wants to warehouse less space in terms of their total occupancy and then plug on top much more flexibility. So it will, I think, fundamentally change central London and the way people occupy space. And then it comes down to the offering, as we were all saying. There are going to be different offerings and, you know, certain brands, because a lot of it's brand association and the lifestyle that people live in it. If they don't keep up with the change and the demand for the occupier, then they won't be successful in being letting their flexible space.
And do you think you might go down the BL route and develop your own brand, or will you just let space to other providers?
No, I just don't think we've got sufficient sort of scale to do that and the portfolio.
Okay, and as tenants, you know, as takers of leases, are they every bit as desirable as every other tenant?
I think the interesting question of that is around how the investment market responds, and that is a work in progress, because, you know, Regus have caught some landlords in the past out with Chapter 11, and that's still the opportunity for uncertainty around what the covenant represents. I think what will happen is that rather than pure institutional investors who will be much more strict about their criteria around the covenant, then more private investors will offer more flexibility for people to dispose of space let to WeWork and the likes of it. I mean, the office group's got a fantastic covenant, and therefore you can't make a
general. Thank you, Jonathan.
You can't.
That's a relief post investment. Yeah, we just work that one out as well.
So you can't make a generalisation about it, but I think it will evolve, and I think agree. It will trade.
Just to pick up on the point of valuation, Damon, just quick, because I think it is an integral part of the discussion. As a healthy stat, if you look at our European colleagues, they normally have leases which can go 3, 6, 9. And so duration for them, as it is in the US, is something they have no understanding of. I mean, whether you've got a 10-year lease to credit good or credit poor is irrelevant. They look at things on a far shorter term basis. If you look at Jacina, which is one of the most successful French REITs focused on Paris offices, the average duration of their lease across their portfolio is 5.1 years. It trades at an implied cap of 3.9%. Not much concern there from both institutional and retail investors. I think British Land have a lease term of 11 years. So it's a very different market concept. So that education, rather than this principle of short lease terms, goes to value, because it doesn't. It goes to basically how you price serviced offices. And I think going forward, we see it more of a hotel type business, where obviously you're doing a multiple in EBITDA, and you've got to run it like a hotel business. It's about creating a service. It's about squeezing every single inch of value. It's about creating brands, retention, creating places where people want to work, live, and maybe sleep. So when people get excited about what WeWork are doing, which is slightly different to what we intend to do at TOG, but you know, building this idea of humanizing the workplace environment, which sounds a very strange term, but it's completely on point. People want to basically work with people they can basically generate ideas, collaborate, and share experiences from. And we're doing that elsewhere in our day-to-day lives, whether it's basically through technology or through social media or just through how we operate and live. So unsurprisingly, we are firm believers of this trend, as are a number of our colleagues.
Okay, and how do you think that education happens, that we take a different attitude to flexibility and shorter lease lengths?
I think there's two ways of answering that. One is basically how does the investor market respond, which is obviously very early but encouraging, I think, in terms of how they price this covenant. I mean, you're talking about a industry which, yes, Regus has been around for a number of years, but what we call the new wave of flexible office providers is a very, very young industry. So that's going to take a period of time to digest how investors look at that isolated, building-specific yield. In terms of the bigger picture, I just think, back to my previous point, there's just a mindset in the UK which stems from historical involvement of many German pension funds who wanted 15-year leases. Well, the world's changing. I think that in itself, bearing in mind the international flows of capital, will start to respond in terms of yields for shorter duration leases.
Okay, thank you. And Ross, what's the Heinz view on flexible workspace providers?
Well, we don't have our own brand yet, and actually within the UK we don't have
yet.
Watch this space. We don't have a significant amount of our portfolio leased to other serviced operators in the UK, although we've got more exposure across Europe. That said, wherever we've had very big buildings, we've always been we've always kind of welcomed serviced office tenants into the building as maybe a 5 to 15% occupier because of the amenity that that's offered to other tenants elsewhere in the building. We've been quite selective over who we've wanted and how they fit out the space and how the space feels. Again, because we always had a sales agenda. But we're completely open-minded about them and think that the amenity they offer is exactly what occupiers want.
Okay, and when should we watch that space?
I don't know. But keep watching. Keep watching.
Okay. Mike, you talked about that some of those big occupier requirements that have been satisfied in London, whether it's Apple, Google, Deutsche. Is there still a healthy pipeline of those coming through, or have we seen the big deals that we're going to see in this cycle?
It's hard to say. Whenever we look at stats from any given quarter, and you'll always get people caveating it, saying, well, yeah, if you exclude the Deutsche deal or you exclude the Apple deal. But you know, those ones always come along. And I think from our own perspective, in this financial year, we've let or put under offer about 1 million square foot, so since April. And I think the positive thing from my point of view is that there's still a healthy amount of demand behind that. We've got a lot of good conversations with bigger occupiers. Not necessarily of the sort of 300,000-500,000 square foot size, but we are talking to the majority of what we're doing is with bigger occupiers, 50,000-60,000 square foot plus, and coming out earlier. That's very much the trend we're seeing at the moment.
And is that pipeline that you are seeing coming from particular sectors, or is it as broadly spread as we
discussed? It's really balanced, which is from our point of view really encouraging. Our main focus at the moment is Broadgate, where we've got 1 million square foot to let. A good chunk of that is under offer, but we are, if you look at sort of the viewings, the presentations that we're doing, I would say well over 50% of those are non-traditional city type occupiers, and that's really encouraging. So we're seeing demand right across the board, even at places like Canada Water, where we haven't even got a planning application or a planning consent, we are talking to occupiers about the opportunity that's there. We're quite encouraged by that.
Okay, and Stephanie, do you see demand coming from particular geographies or domestic or international or particular sectors going forward?
I think there's a lot of demand coming through the professional sectors, or likely to continue to come through the professional sectors, because I think we're in a complicated world at the moment, and that tends to generate activity for professional services, management consultancies and the like to be able to assist with that. the fintech, proptech, technology companies generally are ever evolving, and I'm sure we'll continue to see demand from them. You know, they're the sort of the big superstars of the day, and they're taking a lot of space, and they'll continue to do so.
James, do you think their superstar performance will continue?
Superstar performance. Can I answer your question around just the demand side? Because I think we all benefited on this panel from obviously what was an incredible amount of occupier inertia pre-Brexit and a few months post-Brexit. And as a result, we had proactive, reactive occupiers who were very, very keen to do deals. And as a result, the immediate response was staggering. I mean, far exceeded our expectations. I'm sure people have similar views. Personally, in terms of going forward, we've definitely seen a softening in the market because I think we are now transitioning from a reactive, proactive environment to a leasing market, probably driven by lease events. And so what I mean, you know, tenants who have got a break or have got a lease expiry. And it's a tough conversation to say to those guys, you know, you've got a review coming up, guys, or a break. How about you come into this building? You know, we'll give you some rent free, sign a 10-year lease, your rent's going to go up by X percent, but it's going to help your business, help your efficiency, help your brand, etc. In light of some of the political and economic headwinds we face over the next 2 or 3 years, we're finding a lot of them are just saying, do you know what, it's very kind, we'll come back to you in 5 years. So I think we are going to see a slight softening of that occupier who doesn't need to move. The choices are pretty limited in terms of the supply, which is very reassuring. But I still think we've got to work to basically drag these occupiers onto the page and ink deals. It's not easy.
We'll come back to you in 5 years. That's
very kind, yes. I hope by that stage we'll be in a next cycle of investment and benefiting from that. But I think it's by no means the show is over. Of course not. But I'm just saying I think in terms of the response, which was staggering post-Brexit, we're now basically in a far more complicated occupier environment.
I imagine a few years ago in a recessionary situation, people would say, I'll come back to you in 12 months. It seems like quite an extension.
12 months, yeah, that would be nice, wouldn't it? I mean, I'm probably not best placed, but I mean, I think there obviously has been I think the stats are, and apologies for implying I'm a statistician, I'm not. I think sort of Stephanie's better placed, but maybe headline rents have come off probably 4.5% in the last 12 months. That in itself sounds very reassuring, but obviously then you've got to look at the true net effective discount. And when you have rent freeze going out for 10 years from, I don't know, 20 to 25 today, that obviously goes to the bottom line. So for sure there's an economic implication which is somewhat masked by these headline rents, which are still incredibly resilient. So,
rent Stephanie, freeze do you have those game. Net effective rent figures at your fingertips?
No, not at my fingertips, but you're right. The net effectives have come out quite considerably now, and you know they're at the point that historically you would say that rents have to start coming off. Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Jonathan. I asked this question on our investment panel earlier, which is essentially: wouldn't we have been here anyway? You know, we were in a cycle that had already been toppy for quite a long time. We've had some political disruption. Would we have been where we are today anyway, or are we in a worse or better position?
I don't think you could separate the economic climate from the property market. It tends to, they're inextricably linked. There's the correlation. Would we have been here anyway, i.e. is that political, Brexit or not, would we anywhere? I think a lot of what James said is that there was inertia in the system, which has masked some of the change that is probably coming, i.e. that there is undoubted nervousness about what the future looks like amongst any business as to how they're going to, what will their business be like in the next few years. I think that the property cycle obviously is, I think in London, is a supply-led cycle, really. If you look historically, then when you have a position of oversupply, and there often isn't, but when there is, then there prices fall, and that's when rents fall, and occupiers have got greater choice. That is when then the rents fall. If you look at London historically over the last 25 years, it's amazing how robust demand is over the long period. Even the likes of dot-com crashes, they only lasted 12 to 18 months, not a long, long time in the history of what we're going to go through. So I think, would we be here anyway? We probably would be a little bit more confident about London and growth if Brexit wasn't happening, of course. I think that I was, my analogy is that it's a very, very well-tuned ship anyway. It's well-designed, it's got some great people in it, it's, you know, you've got a good, you've got a good ship where you've actually got to, you've got a reef in the sails. It is going to get choppy, it's going to be difficult. It doesn't mean it stops. It will keep going, and I think that that's where I'd like to sort of pitch the analogy. It's tougher, it's windy, it's a bit miserable and a bit wet, but actually we'll get through it.
Okay, miserable and wet. Stephanie?
I just wondered if I could just make one more comment, is that I think we've talked a lot about kind of standard economics, myself included, over the last 45 minutes or so. What we haven't really touched upon is behavioural economics at all. And also where London sits in the context of the rest of the UK and the level of investment or investment it may not receive because of the kind of behavioural economics that we're in at the moment. And I don't think we can separate it out politically from the rest of the UK. So things like Crossrail 2 is going to be a very difficult sell at the moment because people want to see that level of investment going to other parts of the UK. So London, you know, it's not a standalone place.
Okay, so with that, so this is money going into transport infrastructure in the northwest versus London. So if that doesn't happen, if Crossrail 2 doesn't happen, is there a measurable opportunity cost there? Can you sort of see what, you know, what depressing effect that might have on the London real estate market?
Somebody told me this morning that when Crossrail 1 opens, and I haven't verified this, but when Crossrail 1 opens, it will take 8 years until we're at the level of congestion that we are at the moment. So we don't have that much time to really adapt our infrastructure to the growth that's expected.
Okay, and James, do you look at that opportunity cost if government support for London doesn't happen because of political pressure for it to go elsewhere or it simply can't afford it, that sure will have a further depressing effect?
Simple answer, no. I suppose I work for an international business, so we sort of maybe look at a more macroeconomic, political, geopolitical sort of context, but for sure this is an integral part of why London operates so efficiently as it does, transportation, connectivity, so this would be obviously bad news. Just back to your question, would we be in the same situation despite Brexit and all the negativity around obviously political instability, etc.? I mean, I'm not bright enough to basically comment on that, and there's some people in this room maybe who are better placed, but if you look at the real estate position, I would say no. I think the one reassuring factor, if there is a silver lining to Brexit, is around supply. And as a result of this uncertainty, what people generally do is they defer making material decisions around building very expensive, Class A, brilliant buildings in central London. And if you look at the supply chart that I think Graham put up, it's, I think, a lot better than that actually presents. I think something like 62% of supply which could be delivered by 2021 hasn't yet started construction. I mean, that is, from an investor perspective, a developer perspective, a very reassuring stat. So whilst we may see this volatile fluctuation in occupier demand, hopefully a very stable investor yield, the one saving grace, if there needs to be one, and I'm not too sure there needs to be, is around supply. So I think we are in a neutral position in relation to how this position we find ourselves in today reflects across Brexit and the market.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions from the audience? There are not. That's okay. Okay, in the last 10 minutes or so, let's try and look forward and where we might be in 12 months' time. If we reconvene this panel in 12 months' time, and we may, depending on the quality of your answers to this question, perhaps, what might we be saying? What would you anticipate the position to be in 12 months' time, Ross?
Unfortunately, I'm embarrassed to say as a Brit that I don't think our politicians will be much further forward in 12 months' time than they are today. So
you're going to say there, though.
I think we might be having the same kind of discussion about where they are today, being in the same place. I think the flow of capital to our market will remain strong, so I don't think that that's going to change dramatically. I'd be slightly concerned about the impact. So I believe that the flexible office providers will continue to grow and will continue to take more space. And I'm concerned about the impact that will have on the small floor plate market. And I think if there's, in 12 months' time, we might look back and think that that market is struggling much more than it has been in past years as a result of that. Thought from me.
Okay, well, it sounds like, based on earlier comments as well, that the problem is potentially being pushed a little bit down the food chain.
Yeah, no, I think so. It's kind of Brexit and everything that's come. It feels like wherever the cycle was, it's kind of plateaued at a point and is just trundling along until there is more transparency on which way it's going to go. And it could well be 12 or 18 months before that transparency starts to come through.
Okay, thank you. And Mike, what are you anticipating in 12 months' time?
It's very difficult. I think Stephanie's in the best place to forecast, you know, what's going to happen in the next 12 months. But from our perspective, I think that continued growth of the flexible office market is going to be a trend that will continue and hopefully will be part of. You know, it's going to continue to be hard work to get deals done, but we still see demand coming through and still think if you've got the right product, then you're going to be able to do those deals, assuming you're committed enough to actually get those things done. I think the interesting thing is picking up on this point of supply and what happens around that. You know, the stats around what could still be delivered in 2020, 2021 do rely on a lot of people actually committing. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see whether people actually do.
Okay. And you say it's going to be hard, but there will be commitment. Is that because those occupier shortlists are getting shorter?
I think it's hard because it comes back to this, you know, having to make a decision to move is a big move, and whether it's a break or the end of your lease. If you've got another landlord that's making you a competitive offer to stay, then that's always challenging. No one wants to uproot their staff for no reason. But I think what's playing on the customers' minds that we're talking to at the moment is that supply issue. And, you know, if they don't make a decision, what does that mean in the not too distant future? And I think that's why we're seeing, you know, we're talking to occupiers with lease events in the early 20s. For 40,000-50,000 square foot who are coming out now, and that is a supply related decision. That's why they're coming out.
Okay, thank you. Stephanie, do you see material change in 12 months time?
I think, you know, the real economy looks like it's starting to slow now. That is going to impact on consumers, that is going to impact on office workers and on businesses. So I think it will be a little bit sluggish. I agree with you on that point, and as I said at the beginning, I've been surprised by the level of activity that we've seen so far this year. Do I think it's going to fall off a cliff? No, I just think it's probably going to be the most exciting 12 months.
Okay, James.
So the last but least. I think, candidly, no one can forecast 12 months. I think, you know, what our in-house view is that if you take a five-year horizon, like the majority of us on this panel will do around investing in central London, then there has to be a degree of confidence that, to John's point, you know, we will get through this. The appeal of London as an international investor audience, to the international investor audience, is not going to change over the long term. In the short term, for sure, we've got headwinds around politics, economics, and we're not basically isolated in that, by the way, when you look at the global landscape. But over 5 years, you know, we are still firm believers that the London office market will be an integral part of our global office portfolio. That is how we basically conclude that.
You successfully anticipated my next question, actually, which again goes back to similar in the investment session we had. There was a pretty broad consensus on the panel that we're heading for a tricky period, but we will come out the other side. And you're saying potentially next 12 months difficult, but 5 years' time should be okay.
I just don't know, but I mean, I think all you can look at is basically the current global weight of capital still looking to invest in London, despite all the challenges that we as a panel are trying to debate, and obviously, which is happening real time outside this conference hall. So when you look at the weight of capital, the diversity of that capital, you've got China issuing third quarter growth at 6.8%. I mean, the wealth creation and the appetite for investment in the UK and other parts of the globe from Asia is still very strong. I mean, yes, they themselves have short-term concerns over some capital constraints. But when you look at London, as I mentioned, on a five-year horizon, today you've got to feel we're going to basically continue to get through this period.
Okay, and Jonathan, a 12-month view and a five-year view, please.
Well, I echo what has already been said, really. I'm ultimately optimistic about London as a place to live and work, and I think people want to come here. So I think that the constant noise around the political uncertainty is going to play on the minds of decision makers, and they will sit on their hands if they can. Then overlay on top of that the fact that we're property people, and there's millions of businesses out there, and they're not interested in property, they're interested in productivity of their staff and their creativity and all those things around that, or whether they're inventing the next drug for cancer and so on. And that's what's going to drive the optimistic thing that James talks about, because it's that diversity of thought process and innovation that happens. What we're not very good, apparently, according to the politicians, is productivity, which always I always get quite upset when I hear that, you know, the UK has low productivity, because it doesn't feel like that in London. But I do think we are innovative, and I think that the innovation will continue to happen, and that will drive us through. So I'm annoyed at the politicians for getting us in this mess, and I'm more annoyed about the mongering amongst themselves while they were in this mess. That's really annoying. But I think the rest of us have decided to take control of it, and we'll drive our businesses through. In 5 years' time, London will feel very vibrant and very different, and it will be a very, very exciting place because a lot of the investment that's already gone in it, in terms of, and that's why people want to come here.
So perhaps everyone here should be in the baby show next door talking to suppliers and manufacturers through there.
Well, don't forget that, and it's been a very interesting a lesson for me, because we've done a residential development in Centrepoint, and some of the people who've bought apartments in that are very young, bright people who want to live and work in that part of the world, and they understand what Centrepoint and what London means, that conjunction of Soho and Fitzrovia and Covent Garden. They want to live and work there, and there's some very bright young things want to live there, and that's been really interesting reflection on who's bought apartments in Centrepoint, and so I'm optimistic because of that.
Okay, well, grounds for caution, reasons for optimism. That's a good note to end on. Thank you for coming this afternoon. Please do thank the panel as well. Thank you.